It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a look at the Supreme Court decision on Roe v. Wade, what it means for states, and the precedent it could set for future Supreme Court decisions. First, for many Americans, the United States don't feel very united right now. State governments are passing conflicting laws on abortion, gender and sexuality, guns, and a lot of the other most polarizing issues facing the country. Our next guest says it harkens back to another time in U.S. history before the Constitution was even in place, when the original states that fought in the Revolutionary War were governed by the Articles of Confederation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the differences we're seeing in state laws and policy? Do you see a growing divide between red states and blue states? And where does a state like Wisconsin fit into all of that? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Donald Kettle is a professor emeritus and former dean of the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. He's a former professor at UW-Madison, and he's the author of the book, The Divided States of America, Why Federalism Doesn't Work. He wrote a recent column for governing.com called, Are We Drifting Back to the America of the Articles of Confederation? Don, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, it is good to be with you and with all my friends there in Wisconsin.
I know you've been thinking about federalism and divisions among states a lot in recent years. What led to this column and looking all the way back to the Articles of Confederation?
You know, I was thinking about where we are and where we seem to be going when it comes to dividing power between Washington and the states, and actually wrote this before Roe v. Wade decision came out from the court last week, and was concerned, though, more broadly about whether or not there's really anything that is truly a national issue these days. Is there anything that we all agree on that we want for the government to do on behalf of all of us, regardless of where we live? And it seemed to me that the answer to that question is getting harder and harder to come by, and it's set up even more by the decision last week by the court, for sure.
Remind us, take us back to the era of the Articles of Confederation that ultimately frustrated people enough that they wrote the Constitution.
Yeah, it's such an amazing story, and it's one that for the most part we've forgotten in the course of history since. But after the colonies declared independence from Great Britain, the big question was, okay, now how are they going to govern themselves? And one of the things that happened as we look back over what happened in those days was that the Continental Congress was established and it met in Philadelphia. They decided that they had to have something to be able to govern themselves by. They had a big concern about the one thing they did not want to do is to make sure that they had a king or some kind of ruler as powerful as the king that they were fighting to overthrow. And so they established a system of government called the Articles of Confederation. And it was a loose confederation for sure, with the states still in charge of what was happening. And it took actually 3/4 of the states to get any work done. The big problem was that it got to be hard to get even enough states to show up to vote on anything to be able to get things done. And so we managed to fight and win the Revolutionary War using this, but it didn't last very long afterwards. And it was clear we needed to do something to try to replace it.
The Constitution is what replaced it. It gave more power to the federal government, but not all power. And I know, Don, over the years, from various parties at different times, there's a concern that too much power ended up flowing up to the federal government, and that for one reason or another, maybe it should be pushed back to restored to the states. Where do you see that trend going today?
No, it's the great fundamental issue about American government that is at the core of so much of what we did. It's at the core of what happened with the Civil War. It's the core of what happened with the civil rights battles. It's clear, I think, now that what we see is a strong concern that the federal government, on the part of at least a lot of Americans, has seized too much power with an interest of pushing more of that power back to the states. We saw that in the case of COVID. We saw that in the case of environmental policy and other kinds of issues. But on the other hand, people on the left are concerned that, left to their own devices, the states would push these decisions in the wrong direction and undermine the unity that the United States of America was really aimed at accomplishing. So what we have now, at the very least, is a kind of battle over these issues unlike anything we've seen in at least the last generation. And it's really leading to some deep fractures among the states about the question of where the dividing lines between the federal government and the states ought to be. And a related question, I guess, how much division among the states are we prepared to tolerate? To what degree should the states be able to go in completely different directions? That sets itself up for the big debate now on abortion, but it goes back to the issues of COVID and to just about everything else that's fundamental. The big question here at the core is, what are those things that really ought to be national policy, and who ought to decide that? How much power should we allow to the states to try to sort that out in the meantime?
Talking to Don Kettle from the University of Maryland, formerly from the UW-Madison, looking at dividing lines in American politics by party over issues. One state looks more or less and less like another state in many cases, blue state versus red state, as they move farther apart on issues. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. That's 800-642-1234. How much should states be able to go on their own to decide important issues? How much authority should the federal government have over them? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Don, what do you see driving these really stark divides on so many issues?
In some ways, it's some of the same kind of divides that we've seen throughout American history, and even back to the old days of the Articles of Confederation, and then the days that's really passed that by as we tried to write a constitution of the United States. What's happening now is grave concern that decisions being made in Washington don't match the views of at least some people in some states, and they're calling for more state power to be able to pull the power back to state capitals and use that to prevent the national government, the federal government, from imposing its will on the states along the way. We've seen that back and forth. We fought a civil war over those issues, of course. We had big battles over the issues of civil rights and civil liberties. We had a time when it seemed in the 1960s where we were moving past some of those divisions, but no sooner did it seem clear that those divisions were going past that we began to see big differences popping up again. Things like Medicaid and differences in healthcare. We've seen it in COVID most recently, and now we've seen it on some of these social policy issues that have to do with the core fundamental battles over issues having to do with abortion in particular now.
We're talking to Don Kettle from the University of Maryland, looking at divisions between states in the United States. In a recent piece, he says it's starting to look like the pre-Constitution days. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see driving these divisions? Do you see ways to bridge them? What are your hopes? What are your fears? Call in at 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Don Kettle, formerly with UW-Madison, now emeritus professor at University of Maryland. He wrote a recent column about divisions in the United States for governing.com. called Are We Drifting Back to the America of the Articles of Confederation? Let's go to your calls at 800-642-1234. Samantha is with us in Menominee. Hi, Samantha.
Hi there.
Hi, what did you want to bring up?
I know the conversation usually tends towards federal versus states' rights in situations like with Roe v. Wade, things like gay marriage, and it seems like it's really just a stand-in for progressive or conservative politics that when Roe is the law of the land, then conservatives would prefer to have state rule. But I'm guessing that pretty soon we're going to start seeing movements toward making abortion illegal nationwide by conservatives, because that's what they would ultimately prefer to have. Same thing with when states were deciding gay marriage. It was pushed by progressives ultimately to become the federal law of the land. We would all prefer to have our policies rule the entire nation. And if we can't get that, then we try to have it be states' rights. So it doesn't really feel like there's all that much that divides us as states. It's just whether or not you're winning.
Interesting. Samantha, thanks a lot for the call. The state versus federal argument, a tool, depending on who's making that federal decision, Don, what do you think?
I think that's a great point that Samantha makes, and in particular, the best form of politics is the one where my views win. And so that's the easiest thing to get consensus on. The problem, of course, is that we're dividing ourselves on what it is that we can actually agree on and how we feel about having others make decisions that we don't agree with. It goes deeper, though, I think, than just the winning and the losing, because there are big consequences that flow from the differences among the states. The rate at which children are taken care of, for example, infant mortality, and then by extension, the kind of care provided to their mothers and maternal mortality, that varies dramatically among the states. And so the big policy difference, the kind of air pollution standards that are kept among the states varies tremendously as well. The death rate from COVID has varied tremendously among the states. And so in part, for sure, when it comes to the politics of who gets to decide, is really a question of whether or not I can find ways of making my own values be the ones that win. But on the other hand, there are big policy implications that come along with making decisions in different ways. And one of the big issues, and it's something that I'm working on right now, is to what degree does giving the abortion decision back to the states then create wide disparities in the ways in which children are taken care of? The abortion rights are going to be dramatically different depending on where you live, but so too are the level of health care provided to kids, provided to their mothers, the kind of life expectancies that come out of that. And so there are not only the big fundamental kinds of issues and debates about who it is who ought to get to be able to rule, but also the question of what kind of policy implications flow from that. And it's those implications that are just as important that we need to pay attention to.
Thanks for that call, Samantha. Jim joins us now in Dubuque. Hi, Jim.
I think the founding fathers were right to form a republic rather than a democracy, because an actual democracy, all it amounts to is 51% of the population being able to take away the rights of the remaining 49. Your government all made an interesting observation in his address at the 125th anniversary of the Nation magazine. Said occasionally we make the mistake of trying to think there was, or trying to start a third party in this country, making the mistake to think that there was two parties to begin with.
Jim, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for that call. Don, Jim, bring up a point I think the founders were thinking about. We want to make sure a majority doesn't impose its will on a minority. I've seen arguments that in the current system, with leans in the Electoral College, Senate representation, and more, that we may be seeing a minority of Americans control the fate of the majority. What do you think of what our caller had to say and those arguments?
Yeah, exactly. As you know, this is precisely the kinds of things that the founders worried about. One of the reasons why they went from the Articles of Confederation, where we had a government that proved incapable of getting anything done, to a constitution where the primary goal was that the people ought to rule, that there really ought to be a democracy, but that there ought to be a republican form of democracy where we would elect representatives who would make decisions on our behalf. But boy, were they worried about the issues that might come up that could divide the country, the prospects that a majority might be able to impose its will on the minority, that now, as you suggest, Rob, that we may have the reverse case where a minority of the population may be able to impose its will on a majority, because of the way in which the Electoral College is set, by the ways in which, in many cases, state redistricting is defined as well. And so, in many ways, the founders would recognize precisely these questions. I doubt that they would have imagined the kind of politics surrounding the issues of abortion or even gun control as we have it now, even though, of course, they debated the Second Amendment. But they sure would understand the underlying issues here, because they're precisely the same kinds of things that they debated and, in fact, fought over when first they wrote the Articles of Confederation and then decided how, through the Constitution, they ought to try to resolve them.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more quick call from Michael in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. And I will try to condense my rambling point as much as possible. I was just calling in to say, you know, reflect on how much the country has changed since the Articles of Confederation and the Constitution were written. I mean, we've gone from having fewer than 15 states or colonies to 50-plus territories. We have way more people. The geographic area of the country is massive. You know, an average U.S. state is you know, the same size as or larger than a
Michael,
lot of
Europe. Michael, I gotcha. We just have a few moments left with you. Don, are we bursting at the seams? Is it time for another fundamental review of how we do this stuff?
Well, you know, the biggest problem is that there's nothing wrong with the problems that we face or the system that we've got that easier problems and more consensus wouldn't solve. As long as we have disputes and differences among ourselves about some of these big things, I don't think there's any system or any kind of structure that could just wipe them away. But we are clearly now entering a new stage where we not only have to try to figure out how to talk with each other, but how to try to govern ourselves collectively and to make sure that our differences don't pull ourselves apart. And this is precisely the kind of thing that the founders worried most about. And it's up to us now to try to carry forward in the kind of traditions and the values that they worked and actually fought so hard to try to establish.
Don, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
It's so great to be with you, Rob.
Donald Kettle is a professor emeritus and former dean of the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, formerly with UW-Madison, author of the book The Divided States of America, Why Federalism Doesn't Work. He was with us today talking about a recent column he wrote for governing.com. It's called, Are We Drifting Back to the America of the Articles of Confederation? In many states, incarcerated people have copays for health care, but with low income from prison jobs, they sometimes end up choosing between medical services and things like toiletries or phone calls to home. That can impact the health of incarcerated people and their ability to move forward after serving their sentences. Jonah Balekas is a digital content producer at WPR. He's reported about the effects of the copay system inside prisons. WPR's Melissa Ingles talked to him about what he found, including what Wisconsin's policy is and how it changed during the pandemic.
So with some exceptions, Wisconsin charges $7.50 as a copay for a medical visit. So people in prisons can visit the health services unit for all types of reasons, a toothache, chest pains, a broken finger. At the start of the pandemic, the State Department of Corrections suspended medical copays related to COVID-19 or other respiratory symptoms, and that suspension is still in place. But to see how Wisconsin's policy compared nationally, I looked at an analysis from the Prison Policy Initiative, and some states made similar COVID-related suspensions. Some reverted back to their pre-pandemic stance, and 10 states don't charge copays at all, with Illinois and California most recently joining that group.
Interesting. So $7.50 might not seem like a lot of money, but for someone in prison, how much is $7.50?
It's worth keeping in mind how much money people who are incarcerated make from their jobs, whether it's in the kitchen or a laundry unit. People in prisons might only make 10 cents or up to 60 cents per hour.
Wow.
One man I spoke with, Cedric Farley, said 60% of his paycheck went directly to various court costs. That left him making about $8.94 every 2 weeks. And Farley grew up in poverty. He had to be careful with his money. And one medical copay took up nearly 2 weeks worth of work. A 2017 Prison Policy Initiative story estimated how much a minimum wage worker in each state would pay if they were charged at the same rate people in prison are. In Wisconsin, that was about $600. Farley got out of prison about 2 years ago, and he lives in Eau Claire now. He's still paying off court costs, as well as about $200 in medical debt.
Like that perpetuates poverty because it follows you out here into the world. It puts tremendous, you know what I mean? Put tremendous stress and financial stress on your family as well.
So what kind of decisions did people have to make in prison based on what they could afford?
People in prison without means have to decide between paying for medical care and buying some toiletries or paying for phone calls home. Some felt forced to have injuries or illnesses remain untreated. And that's obviously bad from a health perspective, but it's also true that that can often lead to higher costs for treatment down the road, a cost paid for by people who can't afford it or on the taxpayer-funded prisons. Marianne Olson is the Fox Cities organizer for Expo, which stands for Ex-Incarcerated People Organizing. While she had some financial support through her husband, she said she saw other women in prison have to make these kinds of decisions.
That was a difficult, agonizing choice that I don't think anyone in Wisconsin would want their mothers or daughters or sisters having to choose.
Wow, it seems like a lot of trade-offs. I mean, what are the formerly incarcerated people you spoke with think should be done about it?
So I asked everyone what they would like the policy to be. And I certainly had a lot of people say that they don't think there should be medical copays in prisons at all. People applauded the Department of Corrections decision to suspend copays for COVID-19 symptoms, but they also said that that move suggested the department had some latitude to make policy changes. I heard that the suspension should be made permanent since the pandemic might not have a clear end date. I heard about getting rid of copays for so-called COVID-19 long haulers. And I heard that if copays stay the same, wages should go up. I'll add that the department declined to make someone available for an interview. I would have asked them why they have their policy as it is and why they would or would not consider any changes.
All right. So that article available at WPR.org. Jonah Balekas, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's WPR's Jonah Balekas talking to WPR's Melissa Ingalls about prison healthcare policies here in the state. Coming up after the overturning of Roe v. Wade, we'll take a look at changes in the U.S. Supreme Court over the years, what led to that decision, plus what it could mean for other past rulings built around the idea of privacy, and what happens now at the state level in Wisconsin and all over the country. You can follow recent reporting on the impact of the Roe v. Wade decision over at WPR.org/news, and there are ways to leave your comments on the issue, how it affects you while you're there. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll visit a Wisconsin drag show in 1884. The author of a new book shares the long history of drag performance here in the state. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade on Friday in a ruling that says abortion is no longer a constitutionally protected right. Abortion access is now in the hands of states. In some cases, that means trigger laws passed in recent years. In others, it means older laws still on the books that were preempted by Roe v. Wade. In Wisconsin, abortion law follows legislation from 1849 ruling all abortions are illegal unless done to save the life of the pregnant person, though that law is expected to see some legal challenges. With Roe v. Wade being overturned, some people are already looking to the future of other laws, wondering if the Supreme Court will target right-to-privacy laws, including same-sex marriage and contraception. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support the near total abortion ban Wisconsin now has? Why or why not? How do you want to see it enforced? And do you worry or do you hope for other changes from the U.S. Supreme Court to follow on this one? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Kimmy King is professor of political science at the University of North Texas, specializing in civil liberties and civil rights. Kimmy, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be back.
As I mentioned, Kimmy, this is back to states now. I want to focus on states that either have trigger laws that are coming into effect now since Friday, or states like Wisconsin with older laws on the books. What are you watching for as they turn those laws that were kind of hypothetical into reality?
So it's going to be in the scramble of the patchwork of different laws that you're going to see so many of these legal and political challenges. You have to remember that 13 states, including Texas, where I am, had trigger laws in place. But then you also have 9 states that have previously previously said that there are restrictions that could be brought back into effect if Roe is gone, if there are court orders. So you're going to expect some folks to go to the courthouse and file on that. But then you're also going to see lawsuits in those 13 trigger law states as well. And then on top of that, you know, keep in mind that seven states have laws that express an intent to restrict the right to legal abortion to the maximum amount permitted by the Supreme Court, which is taking it back to the moment of fertilization. And you still have states with constitutional amendments on the books. So there's going to be a legal battle in courthouses across the country based on the laws. But remember, because the law, you know, because it says looks to the state laws, you're going to see litigation as women come forward and say, hey, even under this restrictive law, I need it for maternal health. And so therefore, I should be given an exception.
Already in your neighboring state of Louisiana, a court order has at least temporarily blocked a law from taking effect. What are you seeing there?
Well, that's exactly, they just did that today at noon. And that's exactly the reason why I said what I just said. I mean, in much the same way, you see that Evers there has said that he'll give clemency. So it's not only going to be in courthouses where you start to see this scramble, but it's also going to be in legislatures. Look at Florida. Rubio, you know, Senator Rubio there, pro-life, recognizes that there's going to be an influx of babies that are going to start to be born. And given that you need to have some provision for them within the state, medical services, there's going to be a scramble in legislatures as they put forward laws to provide additional services or to provide to change the state laws in those states that are more purple than, say, for example, you know, we're bright red down here in Texas.
Talking to Kimmy King from the University of North Texas, looking at the Supreme Court decision overturning Roe v. Wade that was handed down Friday, how it affects states around the country, Wisconsin and all the other ones too, and what this means about how the Supreme Court decides issues, especially those related to privacy. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Kimmy, I want to turn a focus to the U.S. Supreme Court now. What struck you about what went into this decision overturning Roe v. Wade and how the precedent was handled by the justices?
It's really striking, and actually in many ways, it's more of the same when we think about the abortion controversy. Roe v. Wade precipitated controversy from the moment it was started, and it has continued to plague the court in terms of its precedent. What is most striking about it is that Chief Justice John Roberts, who has been fairly successful as Chief Justice for cobbling together majorities in opinions that don't go too far in cases, that have stuck strictly to the questions presented before the court, and he's been more of a moderate influence on some of the case decisions that have come out while still being a conservative voice. What is striking about this decision is he's lost control of the majority. And so I think that's why people are looking at, say, for example, the Thomas opinion and saying, what does this mean for the broader scope of rights, given the fact that Roberts is no longer really able to control the other five conservatives on the court?
Let's talk about that. You mentioned Justice Thomas's concurrence. He voted with the majority here, but wrote a little extra. Now, the main opinion written by Justice Alito, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Kimmy, said,
yes, that's right.
This doesn't mean anything about past rulings on same-sex marriage or contraception or sexual behavior and how states can regulate that. Justice Thomas says, yeah, it does. What do you make of that difference?
Yeah, Alito can say all day long that it doesn't make a difference, but the reality is that if you look at the doctrine that Justice Alito is putting forward in his opinion about substantive due process rights, and the fact that, I mean, he's saying, you know, we don't go farther than the case before us. But the Dobbs case, which is the case where they've overturned Roe v. Wade last week, that case, in essence, took up a question that had not been certified before the court, whether Roe should be overruled, and the court went ahead and went beyond the scope of that question that was put forward. And so that's why Thomas is being honest about what is being said regarding the scope of the ability of the court to turn back rights, because the court is in essence saying that on substantive due process rights, courts in earlier eras got it wrong. And if they got it wrong on that issue, why can they not be getting it wrong on all those issues related to LGBTQ rights or the rights related for married couples to get contraception?
Can you talk about that notion of, I don't know my Latin pronunciation very well, stare decisis? It came up in a lot of Supreme Court confirmation hearings in the Senate, including for justices who overturned it. The idea of, even if you don't like it, you have to respect past Supreme Court opinions and only really change that if something has changed in the world, not just because the lineup of justices has changed. How did that all factor into this?
Well, that's really important. And you see Justice Alito going to, you know, extraordinary measures to explain and clarify in the opinion for the five justices that they're basically saying that why should you follow stare decisis if it was wrong in the first place, right? So if Roe v. Wade was wrong, looking to it now and saying, well, it's stare decisis, it's precedent that has been established. If it was wrong, then you are supposed to overturn it. And that's part of why you're seeing people getting angry about the fact that they point to this issue that, well, Plessy versus Ferguson, which is a classic case that said that segregation was lawful and that Jim Crow codes and the Black codes were okay back in the 1800s coming out of slavery and continued up until 1954. They use the example of Brown versus Board of Education overturning Plessy as a reason for why they were looking at overturning Roe. Just understand what's striking about that is that Plessy restricted rights, Brown was looking to expand rights. And here what's happening is that it's clear the net impact will be to restrict rights back to the pre-Roe days.
We're talking to Kimmy King, professor of political science at the University of North Texas, with us to talk about the Supreme Court's recent overruling of Roe v. Wade, throwing decisions on abortion law to the states, and what it could mean for future court challenges to what has been settled Supreme Court precedent on things like same-sex marriage, contraception, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you or don't you want to see Wisconsin enforce the 1849 abortion law on the books in the state now that Roe v. Wade has been overturned? Are you concerned about other Supreme Court protections being changed by the current court? What questions do you have for our guest, who knows quite a bit about the U.S. Supreme Court? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Kimmy King, professor of political science at the University of Texas, North Texas, excuse me. Kimmy is joining us to talk about state abortion laws following the overruling of Roe v. Wade by the U.S. Supreme Court last Friday. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the U.S. Supreme Court now? Are you happy with it? Disappointed with it? Do you want to see changes? What questions, what thoughts do you have about how abortion laws should be put into place and enforced here in Wisconsin and around the country? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to a caller now. Billy is with us on the road. Hi, Billy.
Hey, man.
Good. What'd you want to bring up?
Sort of curious how they always want to keep the women in second class and everything to make a decision on how they have a child or not.
I'm sorry, we got a bad connection there, Billy. I'm sorry. Thanks for trying to call in, though. Let's try Kylie now in Sparta. Kylie, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Kylie?
So I could talk about this all day long, but I'm going to try and keep it short and sweet for you. I am probably the minority here in that I'm happy that the law was overturned, and simply for the fact that any person's rights, so the mother, they keep saying mother's rights or, you know, women's rights. However, the baby also should have rights. And because we, you know, just because technology hasn't come so far that we can detect when life begins, doesn't mean that that's not a life already there. But I also do wish that they would that some other changes would be made, such as, you know, women who decide they don't want to have children can you know, have surgeries like their tube side and whatnot at an earlier, younger age, if they want to make that choice, and more enforcement of the male's role in making sure that they're taking care of their kids as well.
Kylie, thanks a lot for the call. Kimmy, I think Kylie sums up a lot of the argument for the Dobbs decision and for a lot of the supporters of it, but also Kylie hoping for various changes being made to support contraception of various sorts and the economic well-being of women.
Yeah, and it's, you know, what she's getting at is exactly at the heart of what we're debating about the abortion debate. It's important to recognize that the court, in its both Roe decision as well as the Casey decision in 1992, addressed the issue of viability. It has always been the question at the heart of Roe v. Wade of, you know, when does life begin? And if you go back to common law, and you'll see Justice Alito talking about that, there has been this debate about when the state could place restrictions on people, no matter when it was, whether it was back in the 1800s and you harmed a woman who was pregnant and you killed her and the baby, right? Or even through as it was being criminalized through the 1800s of when does life begin? Because it was thought at that point that that's when the government has the ability to get involved. So viability had always been set somewhere between 20 to 24 weeks. Simply because if you look physiologically, a fetus or a baby, depending on your view, cannot survive outside of the womb with the technology that we have until about anywhere between 18 to 20 weeks, just because lungs have not developed. And so that's the issue of viability and the ability. Roe had always said that the mother's rights in the hierarchy mattered up until the point of viability. And then it was at that point that government could begin regulating. So it's this that Roe, you know, stood for. You have to remember, though, that part of the problem is here with maternal mortality. It is actually more dangerous for a woman to carry to term for pregnancy than it is to have an abortion before about 8 weeks of pregnancy. And then it moves on up the scale, with carrying to term being one of the most dangerous instances for maternal mortality. And that can vary depending on your economic circumstances, depending on the medical health care that your state has. In Texas, for example, in my state, we don't have really good maternal mortality and neonatal care for babies. And so it's in those states where you don't have good health services that I would encourage Kylie, that if she cares about these issues and pro-life people, you need to start working with your legislature, because in the next 6 to 9 months, you're going to have an increase in babies that have to be taken care of in your state. And they're going to need your support, Kylie.
Kylie, thanks a lot for calling in at 800-642-1234. Judy joins us next in Milwaukee. Judy, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share my opinion about, people talk about the democratic process and anger at the different sides. And I think on this issue, the best way to find out what people are thinking, 100% of the people, is to go ahead and put it on your ballot or your, you know, a poll or something where every person gets to weigh in, because there could be a silent majority on either side that, you know, we're kind of speculating, right, by people who call in, people who protest, but there might be a lot of people sitting at home, men and women, people that have had abortions or not, that they're like, you didn't ask me. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I'm in favor of, you know, each state, start there and just put it on your ballot. And that way, if you feel very strongly, you go vote on that.
Judy, thanks for the call. Kimmy, some states do have a mechanism, statewide binding referendums, a referenda. Wisconsin does not, though. A lot of states don't have that sort of direct democracy approach to an issue like this.
Yeah, but, you know, to get to what your caller's saying, I mean, the larger issue is that abortion and gun rights and the economy are all going to be on the ballot in November. The difficult issue, and the founders of our Constitution raised this issue, is while I, you know, they wanted majority rule with minority rights, this recognition that the majority could become tyrannical, that there could be this tyranny of the majority where just because you're 51% of the people in the population, you don't get rights because we've voted them away. I mean, imagine if the South had been able to vote on slavery in the 1930s, for example. And so this concern about majoritarianism is at the heart of all these issues, whether it's LGBTQ rights, whether it's concerns about civil rights, abortion rights, the right to privacy. One of the things that Thomas raises in his opinion is that Griswold, which is a decision that allowed for birth control between married couples, might be at issue now because of this decision and how they're looking at substantive due process. So it is very complicated, and it'll be curious to see whether abortion is enough of an issue. Right? With the economy in the toilet, elections have always been primarily about where the economy was at. So the Democrats and those who are pro-choice have a bit of a struggle come November.
Thanks for that call, Judy. Talking to Kimmy King from the University of North Texas about the decision, the Dobbs decision overturning Roe v. Wade on Friday. Kimmy, I wanted to talk to you about the U.S. Supreme Court as an institution. I know justices don't want to have the perception, or at least they say publicly, they don't want to have a perception that they are politicians in robes, that they really do consider the law. Polling from Gallup shows support for the Supreme Court. 25% did I see last week. There have been some new polls since the Roe v. Wade decision. Can you talk about the Supreme Court as an institution and public opinion of it?
Well, the court, in their Dobbs opinion, you can see that they sort of recognize that they're not going to think about what the public opinion fallout will be. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor famously noted that, you know, if you think it doesn't make a difference when there are hundreds of thousands of people outside your workplace protesting you, you know, think again. It's very complicated. They are, in some ways, they have this kind of myth of the black robe. But as we've seen with this issue, it has run over. I mean, we had to pass a special, Biden had to put in place special mechanisms to protect the justices. Justice Thomas was still getting protested outside of his home over the weekend. And most importantly, I think one thing that will be interesting to see is that tomorrow, this is done before a bunch of the primaries are completed. And so tomorrow, you're going to have a number of states, many in bright red areas. It'll be curious to see how those play out and whether there are any differences there as we move through the primary season, because ultimately any public opinion of the Supreme Court should ultimately translate into the ballot box for the two parties. It's just not clear in this case that will happen.
And very briefly, Kimmy, what are you watching for next? What do you have your eyes on?
Get ready for the Texas Attorney General and those states like my own that already had trigger laws in place to go after things like the right to travel, saying that a woman can no longer cross state lines. The right to travel, by the way, is one of those fundamental liberties that Justice Alito talks about in the opinion. And if they start attacking the ability to go over state lines, that's when you're going to start to see some really interesting challenges. Half of all abortions are, almost half, are done through medicated abortions, through Plan B and abortion pills, for example. That will be the next fight. It will also be battles in courthouses to protect women on emergency orders to be able to get access to abortion. And they'll have to do it in other states if their life is in danger, because you don't have abortion providers right now in Texas that are open.
Kimmy, we'll leave it there. Thanks to Kimmy King, professor of political science at the University of North Texas, specializing in civil liberties and civil rights. Kimmy joined us to talk about what abortion law looks like now in states around the country. A lot of open questions. Stick around. There's more to come here on the Ideas Network. Are you a fan of the innovative 19th century poetry of Emily Dickinson and a fan of classic shoot 'em up video games like Space Invaders and Missile Command? Finally, it's your moment to bring those two loves together. As reported in Smithsonian Magazine, there's a new free video game that you can play online in a browser. It's called Emily Blaster. Yes, you can read a poem by Emily Dickinson and then try to shoot the words to that poem in order as they move around on your screen. It's tied into a new novel that actually created the concept of the game Emily Blaster. I played the first round for work research. My poem came out a little out of order. Turns out you got to figure out how to lead the words with your missile blaster. I say let's have more poetry video game crossovers. Doom meets the Raven. Civilization meets Ozymandias. I wandered lonely as a Super Metroid. The possibilities are endless. Poetry game news you can use. This is Central Time.